I would like to welcome you to this afternoon's faculty weigh-in. Last night, Mark Anthony Neal of Duke University spoke about black masculinity in hip-hop and in his speech entitled, How Are You Going to Be the King of New York? This afternoon, professors from a wide range of disciplines will provide us with their reactions and opinions about Neal's presentations, as well as insights from their own research and backgrounds. We are joined by Professor Edward Webb, Assistant Professor of Political Science and International Studies, who will moderate this afternoon's discussion. Faculty panelists today are Stephanie Gilmore, Chair of the Women's and Gender Studies Department, Patricia Van Luard Moonswamy, Distinguished Chair of Africana Studies, Crispin Sartwell, Associate Professor of Art and Art History, Sarah Skaggs, Director and Assistant Professor of Dance, and Carton Seiler, Assistant Professor of American Studies. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Since this program is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before beginning to speak. Thank you, and please join me in welcoming our panel.
Hello, good to see you all here. I see my role this afternoon is essentially to get out the way and let these people do their thing. The order in which I think we're going to take this follows the order as it appears on the back of this. So I'm going to kick it off with Stephanie and Patricia. The one change we're going to make is that Crispin's going to speak last. So Stephanie, Patricia, Sarah, Cotton, and then Crispin last of all. I plan to learn a lot. I hope you plan to learn a lot too. It's pretty much inevitable, I think, with this crew. So sit back, enjoy the ride. Please hold your questions until the discussion at the end, and then I hope we will actually be a real discussion after they've made their remarks. So Stephanie, over to you.
Thank you. I always think about titles because I fancy myself a title diva and rather enjoy them. And thinking about in Mark's talk last night, several times the references to keeping it real, which I enjoy the playing with this. And so I was thinking about my own observations and thoughts on this, and thought about what it is to sort of keep it all too real. Courtesy of my girlfriend, I now have Sirius Radio, and so I can listen to nonstop BBC News or talk radio or country music or the king of all media, Howard Stern. But I often, which I confess that I do, but I often alternate between two stations, Eminem Shady 45 or Hip Hop Nation. I appreciate that I don't have to hear the pauses. And more pauses than lyrics. Censorship at the FCC means that I can't hear fuck or dick or the N-word on the radio, the terrestrial radio, that is. Although I can certainly hear bitch, that's not off limits. Neither are descriptions of hitting women, pitting women one against the other, or sexually exploiting or violating women. I can also hear homophobia and cringe at the resurrection of the tired, no homo, to which I wonder why somebody's not using no hetero, which I think to be a little funnier. To be sure, this form of entertainment is not unique to this genre of music. It is everywhere. It is in comedy, on the internet, television, music, video, theme parties on campus. It is everywhere, and it is grounded, this kind of entertainment is grounded in the exploitation of many people, especially women. To quote Deneen Sharpley Whiting, it is pimps up, hose down, 24/7, 365. And we are forced to the reality that at least in cultural form, it is difficult, if not impossible, to be sexual without being sexist. Given the ubiquity of rape culture, of which the sexual exploitation of women for entertainment is one entrenched example, it would be irresponsible and short-sighted to blame rap music alone. Besides, as Mark noted, as most scholars who work with hip-hop and hip-hop artists know, it is much more complex. The genre, of course, also very closely associated with black and Latino men. As dominant performers and critics use this to reiterate tired tropes of the hypersexuality of black men, of Latino men, reinforcing boring and unsophisticated racist and heterosexist rhetoric. So I'm not about to sit up here as a white woman and a feminist to claim that hip-hop is bad, too, for all women, as if we have no agency and no ability to critique and consume at the same time. And we do consume. Even white feminists like myself think T.I.'s Paper Trail is a stroke of genius. And we applaud what Mark noted as the small political gestures that are available in hip-hop music. We do so even as we critique. Why is it that T.I. and every third hip-hop star feels the need to throw money at women as if we are just whores? And again, that's not unique to hip-hop, just something that I do observe here. I want to think about, and something that I have been thinking about, not me alone, but something I've been thinking about, reading about, is some of the distinctions between hip-hop and hip-pop. The hip-hop certainly dominating terrestrial and satellite airwaves. I get this term from hip-hop from performer Sarah Jones, whose piece Your Revolution openly criticizes male artists for the perpetual commodification of women's bodies. Jones' piece was the center of a court case she launched against the FCC regarding free speech rights when she used the phrase six-foot blowjob machine to reject the idea that women are merely oral receptacles for men's penises, as is often the case in rap, rock music, all sorts of cultural forms. Your Revolution was banned from the public radio airwaves of KBOO. In Portland, Oregon, the FCC fined the radio station. The FCC reversed its decision that Your Revolution is obscene in 2003, but of course the song remains the same. Men can rap and sing about women as sexual objects, while women who reject this idea need to just sit back, shut up, and take it. So back to this distinction. Part of the political purpose of some hip-hop, early hip-hop, of which Jones is one example in a long history, may be to liberate. Hip-hop artists have certainly joined other artists in a sort of voice of political liberation, often radical and revolutionary liberation of oppressed peoples. Gil Scott-Heron, for example, openly critical of a U.S. government that could send Whitey to the moon, but would not feed or clothe poor people, then as now predominantly people of color on Earth. Heron and Afrika Mbata, two important lyrical voices in the struggle to end apartheid in South Africa, using the musical genre of hip-hop as a voice of liberation, a medium by which to express the political liberation of oppressed peoples. Jones encourages us to use a little common sense to get back to our roots and make love de la soul, no pretense. A shout out in part to Artist Common, who now openly rejects anti-gay slurs and has actually taken it upon himself to learn a bit about homophobia and heterosexism, has been fairly consistent in his rejection of that. Of course, as Mark noted last night, hip-hop did help elect a black president. So there's no denying the sort of political opportunity and power of hip-hop. De La Soul, of course, has been critical and self-reflexive of homophobia and misogyny and other oppressive elements in popular hip-hop. Current voices of La Bruja out of the Bronx, Rebel Diaz out of Chicago, push for political and cultural freedom of oppressed groups. Rebel Diaz has noted that they want every single kid that's down for hip-hop, and they want those kids to know that it's not the mainstream crap that is, quote, abusive to shorties or simply about drug dealers, but instead that hip-hop is the music of resistance, the voice of the poor. Although De La Soul proclaimed themselves to be dead in the early 1980s when the glorified violence and misogyny of hip-hop was really taking hold, and this in juxtaposition to Jay-Z, who proclaimed himself dead a decade later in a much more selfish gesture, hip-hop is very much alive. But like the voices of liberation and freedom, those who challenge the status quo, musically or otherwise, rather than simply going along in order to turn a profit, hip-hop remains marginalized in this distinction. But then again, when have we ever really listened to the voices of the poor? Of course, the only purpose of hip-hop was and is not to call for political liberation. That would be certainly overstated. But if the purpose, at least in part, has been to liberate, it seems to me that the outcome, if not intention, of hip-hop is to emulate. As several feminist scholars have noticed, hip-hop can be read as a cultural form that reinscribes rape culture. While it may be performance, it's performance with outcome. And it is one in which, one of many, I will point out, in which women and queer people are sexually violated, abused, and exploited for our entertainment. Nelly's Tip Drill is a most obvious example, of course, and cultural critics and academics alike have shredded him for the video scenes of commodifying women's bodies, complete with him swiping the credit card down a woman's rear end. But in some ways, Tip Drill is business as usual. T-Pain is going to buy me a drink, and for his noble efforts, I'm going to go home with him and have sex with him. How many times do we hear this message? After all, isn't this the economic exchange, the power for money, sex for money, prestige, power, however fleeting? And doesn't this reduce all women to prostitutes? Many rappers turn to the phrase, make it rain, to throw fistful of cash onto women, assuming that if they're dancing in front of them, they must be strippers. And by making it rain, men have license to make it rain later by ejaculating on their faces. Some artists utilize raps to make political statements about poor people's realities, such as the real, if not legitimated, economy of drug dealing, or what it is to be trapped, as Tupac did, to be cooped up in a ghetto in a system of delusion where people are shuffled directly from the elementary to the penitentiary. These same artists, however, do not realize the same commercial success and airplay for their music until they sing about women, and I mean here all women, as gold diggers, as Kanye West Smash It did. And if we all know the line, she ain't messing with no broke, because the FCC won't let you hear the N-word on the radio. Porn star glorifies the idea that we'll just leave the bar, hop in the car, and turn into porn stars to mean that we'll have casual, anonymous, and some downright freaky sex after some grinding on the dance floor, because what we can't do on the floor, we can do in the car. And while there is nothing inherently wrong with hooking up, despite all of the hand-wringing about hookup culture, what is questionable is the assumption, even enforcement, that women must be willing to turn into porn stars and that we must adhere to this popular script. Again, this is not unique to hip-hop. It is, however, a popular means by which this message is reinforced. The music of Rebel Diaz does not get airplay. I hear Bedrock every single day that I listen to Hip Hop Nation. And I wonder where musical scripts are for women to be sexual agents. It certainly isn't Ludacris, My Chick Bad, which does feature various women singing about doing bad things, sexual and otherwise. But it is all scripted for his pleasure so that he can boast about having a chick who do stuff that your chick wish she could. No homo. How depressing. Kanye West, Rihanna, and Jay-Z had to bring that back because inviting someone to suck Kanye's dick as an act of domination needs the qualifier that he's only being violent, not gay. We hear these messages all of the time. Women are props for men, reduced and reducible to sexual objects. It is so mainstream that we don't even think about it when we're grinding on the dance floor. We know what we're supposed to do, and we know how to do it. We're asked to emulate porn stars and strippers and reinforcing tired, boring, unliberating scripts that are everywhere. We don't have to perform as a way to conform. We could do something different. We could use a little common sense. We could use the art of hip-hop not to emulate, but to liberate. It isn't to hip-hop alone, absolutely. But we might want to tap into some of the political roots of this and give some voice to marginalized people rather than conforming to status quo. And when we proclaim that we're keeping it real, we should consider that when it comes to a ubiquitous rape culture, we're keeping it all too real. My thoughts.
At the core of Mark Anthony Neal's presentation, How You Gonna Be the King of Hip of New York, was the question of authenticity in hip-hop performance, and in particular, a hyper-masculine hip-hop authenticity. When Cam'ron publicly challenged Jay-Z's authenticity as an iconic figure of hip-hop authenticity, using his external presentation of self as the context for his evaluation of Jay-Z's right to hold this elite position within the sphere of popular performance, the boundaries of what constitutes the real hip-hop was put on the table. This public queering of Jay-Z, as Neil discussed, called into question not the sound of hip-hop, not the lyrics of the artist, not the political stance embedded in the artistic production, but the exterior markings of the male hip-hop performing subject. It is this aspect of the talk that I'd like to focus upon in my comments, the exteriority of the performing subject and the ways in which this physical presentation of self carries messages of authenticity. As Neil noted, there's a distinction between the hip-hop artist Jay-Z and the person Sean Carter. We can view the exterior presentation of Jay-Z as a mask which serves to enable an alternative performance of self, that of the hyper-masculine hip-hop subject. As Jay-Z altered his masquerade over the years, he broadened the contours of hip-hop masculinity to make room for a more cosmopolitan masculinity, a shift that broadened the scope culturally, in terms of class, and in terms of geographical space, beyond the urban inner-city landscape of New York, and also in terms of temporal space, evoking the bodies of black iconic performers of the past, such as Luther Vandross. The boundaries were pushed also in terms of the look of sexuality, creating space for the metrosexual male whose attention to and consumption of high fashion would have been suspect in the past. But how far can one take the masquerade? At what point does the masquerade so alter the performing subject that the link between subject and permissible context becomes ruptured beyond repair? In the case of Jay-Z, the wearing of jeans and open-toe sandals were a mask that so altered Sean Carter that he ceased to be recognizable as Jay-Z, a particular symbol within the arena of the authentic hip-hop masquerade, from the perspective of Cameron. I'd like to think about the concept of masquerade both as a process of transformation and as a performance of authenticity, and the way in which this is used by rapso artists in Trinidad as a way of authenticating their oral-based performance called rapso, squarely within the performance traditions indigenous to Trinidad and Tobago. Like American hip-hop, the origins of rapso are rooted in the oral tradition of Africa. And like hip-hop, it references a particular cultural, socioeconomic, and historical experience, that of the oppressed class, which is historically black and urban. Unlike hip-hop, however, this continues to be an activist, highly political, and conscious art form that's not been lured from its ideological stance by commercialism. Rapso is a genre of oral and musical performance from Trinidad that emerged as a unique form in the 1970s. It emerged from a group of artists that were politically active, engaged in the struggle for workers' rights, black equality and human rights, economic and cultural equity, and a radical shift in the social structures and psychological ideology of the colonial era. Trinidad and Tobago was a newly independent nation, and there was a rising tide of post-colonial and black consciousness. Rapso evolved from the oral tradition of the griot that was exemplified in the calypso tradition, and as calypso evolved into various forms, rapso was an offshoot that foregrounded the political commentary aspect of calypso performance. There was an emphasis on the lyrical content, with rapso being identified as the power of the word and the rhythm of the word, and the counter-hegemonic orientation of the rapso performance became a crucial identifier of rapso authenticity. The early community of rapso artists was heavily Rastafarian. They were charting a new sound and drawing a direct connection to Africa and the plight of African diasporic groups throughout the world that were struggling against oppression. Young Trinidadians were drawn to the rapso arena and performed a conscious poetic ideology heavily influenced by the iconography of Rastafarianism, but were also mimicking a Jamaican version of West Indian Creole speech as their way of referencing authentic Caribbean consciousness. The elder rapso artists welcomed the interest of the younger generation of artists and encouraged their exploration of performance as a vehicle of political action, but persuaded them to stay true to an authentic Trinidadian identity. Part of cultivating that Trinidadian authenticity was by emphasizing the use of their own voice and style of speech. Another avenue was to educate the youth about the oral traditions that were a part of their history of resistance against colonialism and structures of oppression, and to delineate the evolution of contemporary performance from these older Trinidadian and ultimately African forms. One of these traditions was that of the midnight robber masquerade character. And I'd like to just show you a picture of that character.
before I continue. So this is the Midnight Robber character.
According to the late Brian Honoré, a longtime performer of the Midnight Robber masquerade, the origin of the Midnight Robber character is, he noted, essentially that of an African masquerader or an African oral historian who, when transported to the New World and being eventually allowed to participate in the carnival, in this new situation, utilized some of those ancient skills of the griot, that tremendous memory, that ability to recount genealogy or tribe, the nation, the race, whatever, on festive occasions, but finding themselves in a new situation of oppression and class division, and so they took on the role, not just of historians, but of avengers. So in virtually every robber's speech, the robber gives you some long genealogy of his greatness, his fallen greatness, or the fallen greatness of his family, his nation, his race, his tribe. And then he acquires onto himself notions of power, power from nature, the power of the anti-hero in a society which is divided by class and ruled by monopoly capitalism, and so on. He is the hero in all of this. He robs banks and breaks the city of gold and this kind of thing. His mother was an earthquake, his father was a volcano. He always does this association with the destructive force of nature. And of course, finally, he demands tribute as of right. He does not attempt to present some kind of minstrel-like entertainment to an audience. What his task is essentially, to so either bewilder you with his use of language or to scare you so that you put your hand in your pocket and you pay tribute. So that is Brian Honoré's definition of the role of the Midnight Robber. And as we look at the image of the robber, I would just like to point out that when we look at this image, we have the robber wearing a huge hat that serves to partially conceal his face. His face is further concealed by the use of paint. And so through this, you know, and then we have the long cape and images of that are supposed to inspire fear in that who is he who or she who is beholding the Midnight Robber. It is this external representation of the Midnight Robber that is used by a particular rapso artist by the name of Mark Jimenez. In Mark Jimenez's earlier work, Mark goes by the name of Ataclan. In his earlier work, he directly challenged and channeled the Midnight Robber in much of his work by drawing direct associations with this carnival character. As he progressed in his evolution as an artist, that association became symbolic rather than direct. And if we have time later in this presentation, I'd like to show you a music video of Ataclan in a contemporary critical commentary on Trinidadian society in which he's channeling that energy of the Midnight Robber in his performance. I'd like to just close by commenting that what keeps rapso authentic, even as what the limits of rapso is, has shifted over the years from a representation of a Rastafarian performing body to one in which the representation is more contemporary, is indeed a sense of Trinidadianness that grounds this as an authentic art form. And it's part of the performance tradition of the Midnight Robber masquerade that grounds rapso in this particular authenticity. So I'd like to leave it there and we can continue in the Q&A section.
Can everyone hear me? Do I need this thing to speak into? Is this better? My name is Sarah Skaggs. I'm director of the dance program here at Dickinson. And I'm in my second year here, so it's a lot of interesting. My comments are going to be, are somewhat will be read, and someone will just be riffing on some personal experiences about dance in the academy. I have a confession to make. I had double booked myself last night, so I was not able to go to Mark's talk, but I was able, thanks to the Clark Forum this morning, to watch it on video. So I wasn't able to really get the full effect of him, but I thought it was really curious that he talked about his man crush on Jay-Z, which was very obvious in the talk. And I was like, you know, I sort of have a lady crush on Beyonce, his wife. So, but what I thought was interesting, what that's interesting to me in terms of an artist working in the academy now, is looking for these crevices and how do these crevices and in hip-hop, the break. You know, where are these breaks for individual creativity, expressiveness, agency, and how does that impact on my female dancers here in young, upper-middle-class suburban girls in this form in the academy? And where are the tensions in this? So I'd like to try to talk a little bit about that. So I come from a field of American modern dance, right? This is a field that's highly stereotypical of, you know, this is women's work. This is this esoteric, apolitical, hysterical thing that white women do. It's basically illegible, right? And so it's something that happens on a concert stage. It's our art dance, so to speak. but if we look back at the history of this form, it really, at the turn of the century, really occurs as a pushback from the female dancing body on stage. The only representation of that really was in burlesque. And these are theaters that were, you know, the female dancing body on a concert stage was managed and owned and directed, choreographed by male theater managers. So like the early modern dance pioneers are really pushing back from this and creating really kind of new vocabularies in the body. And these are bodies in pain. And these are female bodies that are literally quite saying, you know, saying, get me out of this corset. And so there is a big premium on expressivity, individual dance vocabularies, and that's kind of like the sort of early launching pad and kind of what I like to hold on is what's, you know, interesting in the form. Of course, it goes through many different things happen to it over decades. But what has to happen for this form is a desexualization of the female body on stage, right? So the female body appears as a goddess, a goddess, a spiritual being, and in some of these early incarnations of the body, female body on stage, there has to be a kind of an appropriation of Oriental cultures in order to kind of create a new spiritually sexual body. But nevertheless, these are these strategies that start to make create this new vocabulary for the female body on stage. So there is this radicalized agenda for a dancing female body. So now let's fast forward to where does modern dance, this dance, meet hip-hop dance? And so this tension arises a lot in the academy where these body practices are segregated and taught in different ways and in different rooms and different buildings. They don't necessarily meet. But just to back up, here I was saying here, the tension arises in the academy in the practice and space of these various dance forms. So you read high, low, right, serious, not serious. And so where is the threat in this, right? And the threat lies in the body, in the like hip-hop or African-derived body practices. The threat is in the sort of get-down, percussive, asymmetrical, polyrhythmic thrust of torso and pelvis, which is in a direct contrast with a Eurocentric, vertical, rational, aligned body. Okay, these are in direct, you know, they're in direct tension. But just jumping back a little bit to my history, is that I'm kind of dating myself here, but that's okay. As a young artist arriving in New York City, I arrived at a time where what I call is like second wave postmodern neo-expressionistic. Yeah, this was going on in New York. Working as a young artist working on the Lower East Side, this is where graffiti artists were showing in galleries, and there was a lot of blurring between hip-hop culture. You know, Fab Five Freddy was rapping in French, and there was this kind of cosmopolitanness and elegance to sort of this form. Fab Five Freddy was also taking Warhol soup cans and bombing the number 5 train. So there was a lot of mixture. Jean-Michel, Basquiat, Keith Haring, Subway. It wasn't necessarily a whitewashing of these forms, but there was this real fluidity between the avant-garde art scene and hip-hop culture at that time. And I remember early on making a dance with Fab Five Freddy, dancing to him, and then Philip Glass. So they were like in the same, so that's why I call it second wave postmodernism. But anyway, there wasn't necessarily this threat. So I come from a place where these forms were quite fluid, and it wasn't necessarily either an appropriation either of it. But so modern dance was embracing vernacular forms, and there were many, many hip-hop groups that were beginning to tour in concert halls as well. But hip-hop did bring this new energy to this dance scene and this art scene that was very, very steeped in a very fierce formalism. And anyway, it was very quite interesting. So I kind of come from that place where you don't necessarily see the segregation of these forms as much until you come to the Academy. But I like to draw on the work of dance studies scholar Tommy DeFrance, who works at MIT. And I just learned from Mark last night, he's moving down to Duke, actually. But in his work, The Black Beat Made Visible, Hip-Hop Dance and Body Power, he does talk about this sort of positive element of the performativity of power and these crevices and the break in the music and in the dance, of course, for this sort of individual expressivity that I am quite attached to. I grew up in terms of this sort of early modern dance concert form. So in trying to find where these two places meet, I think there's a nice crevice there between these two forms. And when I come here, I find a young female dancing body sort of imitating Beyoncé or imitating these sexualized, hyper-sexualized forms in hip-hop dance. Once we kind of open up the dance space to many different kinds of groups, you start to see in the same space or in the same classroom, you can talk about Lady Gaga, you can talk about B-Girls and Rockefeller, and you can talk about Urban Bushwomen, a postmodern dance group, in the same place and with a new kind of possibility for expressivity and a new empowering of a sexual dynamic in the female dancing body that is not a desexualization. It's not necessarily a a replication of a sexual body, but a new kind of agency in these forms coming together in this blurring of what we're actually trying to do here. So I just wanted to say in that way, I think that this is how I kind of try to navigate these forms in terms of the hip-hop body, looking for these crevices, and how these different forms, concert, vernacular, meet in some form. Anyway, a lot of discussion about that, I'm sure.
Yes. I guess so.
One of the things that I was thinking last night when Mark was talking goes back to perennial questions that always pop up when I think about hip-hop, when I think about popular music and popular culture more generally. And the question can basically be boiled down to, what counts as political? What is a political gesture as opposed to a gesture? What makes something politicized? And one of the things, I think we need to be very careful about this, because what happens to the political gesture is that it has to be contextualized. It's different in different historical contexts, in different geographical contexts, and when it's done by different people. And so I think about in terms of African America and other subcultures of color, what we have to think about is the historical moment in which the gesture is made. At the turn of the 20th century, the very idea and the very articulation that people of color were victims and to assert their victimhood, this was a massive political gesture that was absolutely militated against by white supremacists. People of color aren't victims. They simply get what they deserve, and this is the natural order of things. So the political gesture of asserting a victim identity was a very powerful political weapon at the turn of the century. A little bit later, the idea of voting. Voting as a political gesture. We all understand voting as sort of the most procedural, formal political gesture we have. But for African Americans and other people of color to assert that was a powerful political gesture. In my research, some of you may know, I look at driving. To drive a car, to assume the driver's seat and the vantage of the citizen and the participant in full in the American polity, this is a political gesture. So if we think about that in terms of what counts as political hip-hop and what doesn't count as political hip-hop, and some of the things that I was hearing last night and on the very good student panel earlier this afternoon was that hip-hop is no longer, or is at least currently infrequently, political. That it doesn't have the same sort of political edge that it had at one point. And I think one of the things we see as hip-hop begins to gray, hip-hop is now, just like Professor Webb, nearly 40 years old. And so what we're seeing is this sort of conservatism that's attaching to the past of hip-hop. And I think an important intervention right now for scholars who study popular culture is to think about the fact that hip-hop's politics has almost never been directly what we think of as addressing electoral politics or even cultural politics per se. But in the origin of hip-hop, and if we're really to trace it to an epicenter, we got to say the South Bronx in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And if we think about that cultural and socioeconomic context, the political gesture of hip-hop was to have a party, was to have a good time, was in this immiserated space to have fun and to play. The fact that these people were playing with words, with technology, was in and of itself a political gesture. The first hip-hop songs by DJ Hank, the Personality Jock, by the Sugar Hill Gang, these are all party songs. What we think of as political or conscious hip-hop arrives in the early 1980s, really, with Grandmaster Flash as the message. But we have this sort of, this patina of the golden age of hip-hop that we think took place in the 1970s and 1980s, when hip-hop was really political, man, and it was really addressing the immiserated conditions of the ghetto. But in fact, that's a much later add-on to hip-hop. It's a powerful one. But so that's one of the things I think we need to think about is the gesture of the party and the good time and the jubilation that comes out of early hip-hop. We need to think about that as political. So a little bit later, the gestures that are made by what we think of as the more typical political rappers or conscious rappers, by Public Enemy, by N.W.A., and others I'll get to in a minute, we tend to think of as true politics. And we also attach an authenticity to it because they were reporting, almost as if they were journalists or anthropologists, what was really going on the streets, man. This was what was really happening, the hard stuff that was happening. But in fact, N.W.A. and a number of other hip-hop artists of the so-called gangster rap genre freely admit that a lot of that shit they made up because, you know what, it sold. As Mark said last night, that a lot of these narratives of hyper-violence, of sexual violence, are things that are fabrications because they know that people purchase it. Who are the people that purchase it? Generally, as Enrico Zamarchi said earlier today, the large component of the hip-hop audience who are white suburbanites, who are looking into African-American culture for a type of authenticity and a type of hardness, especially young white men, for a type of hardness onto which they can attach and that they can approximate in their own lives. So a lot of what we think of as the real rap that was really reporting the conditions as it was in the 1980s and 1990s, we need to problematize and think about, well, a lot of this is fiction. A lot of this is the creation of consumable fictions. The third dimension is that one of the interventions that's being made now that Mark spoke to very eloquently last night is the promotion and the assumption of the entrepreneurial male persona. This is a major intervention in the political culture of what would we call it? The post 9/11 moment. I mean, it's happening in the 1990s as well. But to assume this entrepreneurial masculine self was a new way of making a political intervention, especially in an America in which more young black men are in prison than are in college. And of course, college is the springboard to socioeconomic success, ideally the boardroom. So the entrepreneurial gesture, I think, is something we need to unpack and think about a little bit more. Final point I'll make is that the gender politics of hip-hop are very complex, and that what you see in the even as far as the 1970s with Latina bands like ESP, but also in the 1980s with Salt and Pepper, En Vogue, MC Light, Queen Latifah, and then later on Missy Elliott especially, is that what you have is a dialogue about gender and about sexual politics being joined by women in hip-hop in a very agential way that is really about stepping to what they regard as the most egregious sexism in African-American life. So it becomes a dialogic type of situation, a dialogue within the black community about gender politics, about sexuality. So I want us to think about those things, you know, really complexly in terms of what counts as political. And one thing that's political in one moment might not be political in the next. And of course, we see also that power structures reshape themselves to absorb political challenges. And so the politicization, for example, of being a hippie in the 1960s was very neatly absorbed, marketed, re-commodified, and didn't have the same political teeth in the 1980s or 1990s. And now I'll shut up.
One thing that this whole couple of days has got me thinking about is the place of hip-hop in academia. One question I have is whether we're killing it. You know what I mean? Like by thinking about it too hard or something like that. Like, I mean, it seems to me like hip-hop must be an incredibly compelling art form, or it wouldn't lead to this much conversation. But what I tend to lose in, I guess, in some of these sessions and stuff is a sense of what makes it compelling initially, or like what sorts of pleasures it provides that keeps people, that makes people identify with it, want to talk about it, or want to, you know, diss it, or, worry about it in one way or another. Like, you know, so, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I've been, I guess for 20, 30 years, I've been thinking about pop music of various kinds. I mean, I love pop music. I probably love it more than anything else in this world, all right, more or less. I think about it as much as I think about anything, all right. But I also feel often that I'm thinking about it too hard, and I've written about it too much. You know, and that I'm killing what I love, you know, by becoming too conscious of it. Now I can't help doing that, but I can't help worrying about it, you know, in certain ways. And so I feel like, and you know, also I think we should think. Well, hip hop is interesting because I think it has more of a role in academia, or academics are more worried about it. than any other popular music form. And I sort of wonder why that is, really. I wonder how, when professors get hold of hip-hop, you know, how they channel it through their set of concerns or issues in a way that maybe, you know, distorts the phenomena as they exist, you know. So on the way up here yesterday, I was listening to Tammy Wynette, whom I love. I mean, Tammy Wynette is maybe my favorite singer in any genre in history. Okay? Now, does that mean I endorse her gender politics? Or even understand her gender politics, you know? Or, you know, no. Well, I don't know, maybe. I don't know. It's interesting. I think her gender politics is interesting. But I'm not absolutely sure what it is. And I'm not sure what my place is in relationship to it. So, you know, if I'm listening to her sing Stand By Your Man, or she's kind of portraying this submissive woman, perhaps, am I getting off on that? Or is it just the quality of the singing, or whatever? Or how ambiguous or ambivalent is Tammy Wynette? You know, very, I would say. You know, it's a pretty complex text. But if I think of it as a text to be deconstructed and stuff, you know, eventually I'm going to want to stop listening to the records, which are just so good. You know what I mean? Like, and you know, as a gender theorist, Tammy Wynette is probably not as good as a lot of professors. Do you see what I mean? But as a singer, she's infinitely better than any professor. If you see what I mean. So, I worry that we're losing... All right, look, I mean, okay. So, I'm not very happy with the politics of the papacy in the 16th century. Right? Does that mean that I shouldn't appreciate the paintings of Michelangelo, which represent that theology? Do you know? I mean, so, I think that, you know, if you're thinking about Michelangelo, you better put it in relation to those institutions and that, like, you know, that political slash religious system. It's an interesting, the paintings of Michelangelo, for one thing, are a very interesting way into that. You know, I mean, you could let that draw you into questions about, you know, the role of the Pope or the Reformation or the corruption of the church circa 1510 or whatever it may be. But if you look at the Sistine ceiling and go, you know, the Pope is not politically correct, or the Pope's view on gender relations, as represented within Michelangelo's work, let's say, you know, or the Catholic Church's representation of gender or something, you know, is ferociously wrong, and you leave it at that, I mean, it seems to me like, okay, well, you're missing the art. You know, so in some ways, like, I want to say, okay, so, you know, I'm looking at Jay-Z videos. I have to condemn, in some ways, the representation of gender, say, in Jay-Z videos. I certainly am not that happy with the portrayal of, like, this total romance of consumer capitalism at the very, very high end, you know, and, you know, life means the best brand of vodka or whatever, or my brand of vodka. You know, or the Rolex or something like that. I mean, I repudiate those values utterly, I would say, okay? But you know what? That's a pretty damn cool video or whatever. You know, that's a good beat. And when you get right down to it, it's not my job to grab Jay-Z by the lapels and say, you know, you capitalist, sexist motherfucker, you know? I'm better off just buying the record, you know, or, you know, downloading the record and listening to it. Or, you know, yeah, I mean, I don't want to have the gender attitudes that Snoop Dogg was representing in 1993, you know, bitches ain't shit or whatever. I mean, I think that's disgustingly wrong. But I do want the music. I want to put on the music. and I want to enjoy the music. Right now, I think I have to look. Maybe this is sort of an index of my privilege in relationship to this material. Like, I don't have to worry about Snoop Dogg's sexist attitudes because I'm not liable to be the victim of such attitudes if they play out in reality or as they play out in reality. So I'm free as a middle-aged white guy, whatever, to enjoy them. All right. And I admit, like, I do enjoy them, all right? So it's not only the beat, I find the representation of gender in, say, Snoop Dogg titillating, all right? If I'm watching scantily clad girls in a video, all right, I'm a heterosexual man. I'm liable to look, you know? I take a certain pleasure in that. Now, I see the problematicity of the whole representational system, but it's not my job necessarily to fix that. I mean, maybe it can bring me into a culture, or it can bring me into our culture in a certain way, or I could try to reflect on Snoop's attitude and my response to Snoop's attitude. But, you know, if I do that too much, too obsessively, too long, I miss the art, just like if I obsess on the papacy while I'm looking at the Sistine ceiling. I want to somehow endorse my own pleasures while at another level realizing that they're, quite problematic, we could say. But what I don't want to do is lose the pleasure and lose the art in the discourse about the art, I would say.
Thank you, everybody. I think this is an art form robust enough to stand up to a little discussion more and maybe some questions from the audience. We've got a lot of themes there that I think we can grapple with. I'm glad this guy is our sort of patron saint up here. There's a great narrative there of violence and extracting money through violence that speaks to a lot of what was going on here. So what we have is self-expression and commodity, right? We have violence that sells. We have parties that sell. We have gender politics that sell. I think that's a theme that's been running through here that is worth us thinking about, particularly the fund that sells, the party. I think we've got to keep on that. What I'd like to do is maybe gather a few questions and then get the collective wisdom here to respond. So if the mics could go where they need to go, and we'll gather those questions. Thanks.
I just had more of a question. It's probably more for you, Professor Gilmore, regarding, modern-day female MCs or rappers. And do you feel that maybe the image they portray, that at least what I see with my own eyes, is that, they kind of are sex symbols in, the rap game, quote-unquote. But do you feel that maybe they've kind of fallen for the trick that's all women are good for, is just being used as something for sex or men's pleasure? Or do you feel like that maybe they've taken that power and now feel powering, saying to a man that you can't, I'm too good. You want me, but you can't have me. Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah, and I think it is. It's very interesting to sort of tease out what these images might mean. And the representations, and I think certainly something coming out of Mark's talk last night, the sort of separation of the individual as an individual and the individual performance, and thinking about that. I would argue that it's really not a form of power in that kind of hypersexualization of women. It's still done for male pleasure, and there's really not enough sort of going on to say, oh, yes, this is really about women, and this is really about empowering women, because our sexual discourse just is such that it's really not the province of women to own and control their own sexuality vis-a-vis themselves. So I think about some of the complex images that are at work, and coming to where we can really see this as empowering or not, I'm not completely sure. I am struck by something that that Mark said last night about and maybe thinking about putting more feminism and more of a feminist angle in here, and that it would be great if prominent feminists sat down with hip-hop artists to say, hey, dude, here's what's wrong with what's going on, you know, in your work, and really sort of illuminating them. My response back to that is, well, that sounds like it would be a really great idea, but I'm not sure that it is really the job of a feminism to get out there and educate people about what's wrong with their sexist gender politics. I think it is, in fact, the job of men to undo sexism, just as it is the job of white people to undo racism, just as it is the job of heterosexuals to undo heterosexism. That burden doesn't fall back to the people who are victimized by these structures and dynamics. And I think that some of that really does come back to inform why it is that it is so difficult to see some contemporary female MCs and artists who are hypersexualized as, in fact, empowered. Because the power doesn't really... it might be a fleeting power, but it doesn't really belong to them in that they don't control and own that space and language. Does that?
Oh, we can do it that way too. So, are there several questions that we could take together, or do you want to just keep doing the one-on-one like this? Because I think probably panelists want to respond to each other too. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, at the back.
I have questions for Professor Sartwell. It seems that you kind of don't want to take a responsibility, but in a sense, you kind of do by creating a consciousness in your students in your class about what is hip-hop, and while you kind of don't really promote a certain idea, you do allow like different ideas to be put forth in the class. So while it's like not your idea to like make Jay-Z do his job, I think you do have a certain responsibility to have your students form their own opinion. So,
yeah, Andrew's in my politics and hip-hop class. I guess that's probably pretty obvious or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing, I want to register my ambivalence about teaching a class on hip-hop. You know, and I guess I probably have done that, too. And it's not that I don't think we should reflect on... And we should let, you know, things like hip-hop become occasions to reflect on our own values and our own positions and so on. But I don't want to, you know, let's say foreclose the experience of the music in a political interpretation of the music, for example. Okay? And I don't... You know, I don't know how successful I am at this in class, but I don't want to direct you toward an interpretation of the music in such a way that, you know, your own experience of the music is undermined or something like that. Now, I mean, that's hard to... I think that's a hard line to walk. And I probably, you know, sometimes I... You know, probably fail at that. I mean, especially I think probably with regard to issues of race, I'm liable to maybe be a lot more directive about what this means or something like that. But yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Does that ever really happen, though? I mean, is any artistic text really does it sort of close up like a hermit crab upon analysis, or does it in fact? I mean, this is something I talk about, and I see some. some American Studies students here, and American Studies students, right, you're always accused of being no fun because you always have this analytical lens on whatever popular culture text you're looking at. Sure, women's gender studies students, anybody who's really analyzing culture for the power relations that are contained in those texts. But, you know, we never say, like, well, I don't want to ruin Shakespeare by studying it. Or I don't want to ruin sex by studying it, although you might. But don't these popular culture texts, don't they yield, in fact, more? Aren't they enriched? And so you have that sort of visceral enjoyment that I'm a big Tammy Wynette fan, too. And I actually find a very powerful feminism in a song like Stand By Your Man that is not any sort of academic or doctrinaire feminism, but there, she's empowered in some sense in that song. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but to me, every great piece of popular culture, to bring hip-hop into the academy, on the one hand, you don't want to lay it out on a slab and dissect it, right? But it's also a form of veneration. This is something our culture takes seriously enough to have a class in art history or in American studies or in music or in dance, women's and gender studies, about these things. So I'm not so sure. I'm not terribly worried about that. I don't feel that same ambivalence to bring pieces of popular culture in that, in fact, I love and to interrogate my own love for them, which, as Professor Trotwell said, right on the money, that some of the things I love are problematic. But I also, I'm not outside of this culture. I'm a subject of this culture. I was socialized into it. And so who better to look at in some ways?
Well, and I think we certainly have the abilities, all of us, in or beyond the academy, to critique and consume at the same time. You know, so I think, you know, being able to enjoy that and to enjoy it with often very intelligent people, such as those we encounter in the classroom, can be a great deal of fun and actually does bring, in some ways, more enjoyment, especially, you know, for various musical forms. I think all of us really appreciate music and aren't going to, you know, throw the baby out with the hip hop.
And just to dovetail off of what Stephanie's saying, I think that, you know, in the academy, that analyzing, studying, dissecting, deconstructing, what unpacking, and then also the practice of it, where does theory and practice meet? Mm-hmm. And then informed bodies can really enjoy the pleasure and historicize it rather than just replicating it, and create new forms can come out of that. And that's what I find really exciting. And, you know,
okay, I guess I'm wondering, we talk about this in class sometimes, and I think it's really interesting when we try to think about, say, like, NWA or the gangster genre. Like, we're thinking about, I guess, maybe a fictionalized narrative that's commodified and obviously consumes pretty heavily. And then I think we get into, I guess, the sexual politics, the gender politics. We think about what it might mean in black communities, in, you know, larger American culture. And I wonder, what's, I guess, the right way to think about this era, or even, you know, subsequent eras of hip-hop? Is it right to really interrogate the commodification of this narrative, think about why it sells, think about who it speaks to, or is it important to treat it as, I guess, a more real cultural text and think about what NWA's lyrics might mean for gender politics in the black community, sexual politics in the black community? So is the commercial or the commodified aspect of this kind of hip-hop really where we should be focusing, or do these have real, I guess, important and academic implications for sexual politics, gender politics, black politics, what have you?
Well, I mean, do you think that the commodification itself has political implications, right? I mean, you know, and the relation of maybe the commodification of the art and the commodification of women within the art and the celebration of commodification within the art. Those all seem to me related. Now, I mean, this is kind of an example, I guess, of where I feel like academia does tend to kill some of this stuff, because I don't think you can have hip-hop entirely outside the realm of commodity. All right. So, I mean, if you took out the profit motive or the product from hip-hop or the capitalist ethos of out of hip-hop. I mean, not that it hasn't been critiqued within hip-hop. I'm not sure what you would have left, you know? I mean, it's an art form that arises at a certain moment within a certain context of capitalism, and it provides commodities, and it consists of commodities. And, you know, I guess we could be anti-capitalist and say that's bad and search for the pure hip-hop. I don't think you're going to get much farther than maybe somebody flowing on the street corner or whatever. You know, I mean, if you think, for example, Public Enemy is, you know, pure of commodity or something, I don't think you'll understand what they're doing, even as they're critiquing that within their own commodities, right? But I mean, this is a situation where to disseminate this material at all, you have to run through the distribution systems of capitalism and stuff like that, okay? I mean, and it's all about, like, appropriating and reappropriating commodities, like in sampling and so on. And, you know, I feel like sort of like a socialist critique of hip-hop as commodity, you know, is going to miss the essence of the art and is also going to miss the pleasures of commodity. All right, which is a theme within hip-hop, an important theme, like that Jay-Z video we saw last night or whatever, that's all it's about, really. You know, but it's also it's a reality in our lives that we are experiencing and repudiating simultaneously. And I think we have to, like, try to, you know, I'm worried that We interpret these things politically along certain well-trodden narrow lines, and that obscures our understanding of the material, you know, and our appreciation of the material.
And one of the luxuries of other forms of non-popular, well, it might be popular to some people, but let's call it high culture, is the fact that it appears to be impervious from commodification. Like, for example, classical music, which is stored in these places called conservatories. And that would be, I mean, I think what Professor Sartwell was talking about, this would be the death of hip-hop if it was a conservatory object. And probably, though, it will become that. But you know what? Culture is going to move on. And 100 years from now, people are going to be in this room, and they'll be talking about some new form that we can't even dream of. And so, to me, the commodity form is not so much the issue, because I think we can all say that most art, and also, you know, as Professor Hartwell says, it's a moment in the history of capitalism. But guess what? So is academia. What we do too is a moment, and it has a function in capitalism as well. But to me, what's more problematic is when people politicize hip hop in a sort of, I think, a really sort of ham-fisted way. Where people on the left say, oh, well, these are the conditions of the ghetto and we need to alleviate this and this is the cry of the poor or something like that. And on the right, they use it as some sort of, look at what awful things that poor people and black people are doing. For example, the first George Bush's castigation of Ice-T and his band Body Count for their song Cop Killer. Well, guess what? Cop Killer is not even a rap song. It's a heavy metal song. And the only thing that made it rap was the fact that the guy who sang it and the other musicians in the band happened to be black. But the idea that this was some sort of reportage of how people in the ghetto were feeling and they had to be punished for it, this to me is one of the ways when people don't really understand hip-hop as a narrative form and as an art form. That's about taking the materials of everyday life, but also shaping them in the same way that Shakespeare shaped them.
So, but what I'd like to, you know, to tag on to that is that, you know, an alternative to commodification, as you say, is, you know, to have these artistic forms reside in a conservatory. The flip side of that is to have them circulating in the underground, you know,
circuits, which is where Rapso circulates. Okay, it isn't commodified, but it does exist as a marginal art form, you know, as an alternative art form transferred through live performances or through artists carrying their self-produced CDs in their backpacks and selling it to people on the streets. I do think that we need to be concerned about the way in which hip-hop represents Black America, because there is so very much misinformation about what Black America is, and that for people that are not well-read or, you know, critical of hip-hop as, you know, a commercial form that is intended to sell, that there is the conflation of what is seen in hip-hop videos and the way that structures of power respond to Black folks in America, you know? So for sure, you know, there's the way that authority figures in America are looking at a class of people and seeing them as deviant and being more likely to, you know, take a Black man who's driving down the street in his car at 1 o'clock in the morning, like my son was, and pull him over, you know, to be arrested when he wasn't doing anything, you know, on trumped up charges that he had a tail light, you know, not working. So I think that we do have to pay attention to the way in which this is a representation, a misguided representation of you know, what all of Black America is. And we need to be concerned with that.
Okay, question down here.
I'd like to thank the panelists for your words and for weighing in, and I'd like to just point out that hip-hop actually operates on all three of those levels. It mm-hmm. is in the conservatory, it is commodity culture, and it, in fact, circulates on the underground. So it's interesting to see what will happen. And, of course, it's international. It's not just rap music. There are other forms. But the thing I wanted to say is just to trouble the distinction between the scholar and the artist, or hip-hop, people who produce hip-hop and people who study hip-hop, and, in fact, make room for people who do both, mm-hmm. or particularly one of the elements of hip-hop, foundational elements of hip-hop that often gets left out is the knowledge, and that was part of when the elements sort of came about and started to be articulated, that is one. So that there was a sense, maybe it's more muted now, that part of it, as KRS-One would often say, is to kick knowledge, you know? So that whether that hip-hop, in fact, is a form of theorizing. And that's what I wanted to say, that this is theory, right? And it's not fact, it's not fiction, it's theory. And it can be refuted, and it can be complicated, and it can be interrogated, and it can, you know, that it does a lot. We may not be able to nail down what it means, but we can talk about maybe some of the things that it does. But so I just wanted to just offer that as that this is a part of theorizing too, and it's not only scholars who are theorizing, right? Or it's not only outside of the academy where people are producing this kind of art. And I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
I think that's a good corrective to what I was saying, as a matter of fact. Right, and I mean, one thing to notice about hip-hop is that it's the most text-heavy musical form, you know, this side of opera, or maybe it's more text-heavy than opera. So you can, you know, so you can tell us, you can write a novel and speak it in hip-hop. You can, or you can have a theory, or you can present, yeah, your knowledge of self, or, you know, the nation of gods and earths, their theory of reality or whatever in hip-hop in a way that's very difficult in most popular music forms. And, I think of someone like Immortal Technique, who is, you know, people were talking about that in the student session today. There's all kinds of theory in that material, actually. That's right. And, yeah. Good point.
One of the ways that I write about the community of artists that I work with is to think about them as theorists, as organic intellectuals, because absolutely they are. Some are, have got a more traditional route in terms of a university education. Some haven't, but that doesn't mean that they're any less able to sit down and look at the conditions in which they're living their lives and analyze and see the disparities and the inequalities that are reproduced, you know, in the contemporary moment that are a legacy from colonialism and those inequalities of relations of power. So absolutely, you're right on target in talking about, you know, artists as intellectuals, too.
I think as students who come into the academy from these to study hip hop, I mean, it's just really fun. I mean, there is this real pleasurable, just the dynamics and kinetics of it. And so once they encounter that, you know, students encounter that, it becomes a really powerful mode to use your body. It's not ballet. It's not going, it's going against the vertical. Right? And it's interrupting flow. It's interrupting that flow and breaking it up in the body. And that's highly complicated, and all kinds of things can happen in that. So.
Right. It's amazing teaching stuff that people actually want to learn. You know what I mean? Like, I teach a lot of like Plato and Descartes and stuff like that. And the students are just like, you know, at best, they're polite about getting through it. You know what I mean? But so teaching like a course on hip hop, it's just great, you know, how enthusiastic people are. I mean, you put on videos and they start applauding and stuff, and it's wow, you know, that's a good thing.
I think these are probably the last two questions given the time. So one down here and then Harry.
Okay, basically Professor Sitter said that we need to consider the context of a gesture to define if it is, or even more, if it is not political. And you brought up the example of the party in the 70s. Now, with today's context, what should we consider as political, and even more important, what is not considered as political at a mainstream level that you feel it's definitely political instead?
Well, I think Professor Munsami's comment is really well taken, that there's underground stuff that's deeply critical and stuff that we would recognize as more sort of standardly political. But I disagree with her in that I think that stuff's commodified too. It's just a question of scale. That the artists are performing, they're getting compensated in some sense for their performance, and the cassette tapes that they're carrying around in their backpacks, they're probably selling. And so I just think of a commodity as anything with an exchange value as well as a use value. And so I see that as commodification too. But I think the questions are all about the circuits of distribution. And that's why the internet is so interesting right now, is that these underground artists can have a presence that they've never had before, and are able to reach audiences that they couldn't dream of even 15 years ago. So what's political now? Well, I think we need to take Mark's comments seriously and his understanding of this sort of entrepreneurialism as more than what it is on the surface, more than just the Rob Report, live in large planes and helicopters and things like that, but to think about what that sort of cartoonish, sort of Richie Rich persona might mean in terms of a new understanding of the means to equality and black empowerment. And I think Obama is really a major figure in that as well. So there's always going to be the really sort of manifestly political with us that's going to come from the underground. But, you know, what we see, and this, you know, I'm sort of a card-carrying Gramscian. So I would say that what happens if those oppositional voices, and, you know, conversations I've had with you, you know this about me, those oppositional voices, if they're loud enough and if they garner enough of an audience,
those larger machines of consumer capital are going to try to suck them in and make them speak for them and absorb them and thereby neutralize them. So I think the political is always fugitive. It's always sort of skirting around the edges of that. And to get into those larger patterns of distribution is an artist has to change their political gestures in order for them not to be completely neutralized, or to have what they're saying become hackneyed and really not having any political traction.
I think it's interesting thinking about that because I'm struck repeatedly as I think about some of the things that are happening here about the differential of power vis-a-vis gender. I mean, you know, thinking about Brian's comment or question about, you know, commodification or sexual politics, I don't think you can divorce the two. And thinking about, you know, the idea of marginalized voices, if they're just loud enough, if they can just, you know, sort of speak in, then they can really sort of, they'll be absorbed into the structure and you know, sort of mobilized to speak for that. I mean, think about, you know, everything green now these days, you know, the sort of greening of everything. And what that really sort of does to diminish a lot of the political impetus behind this. One thing that's really not happening, and in spite of the numerous voices really sort of speaking out against, you know, the sort of the reflections of some of the gender politics taking place in all sorts of forms, and I'm not even trying to limit this to hip-hop, is really, you know, this the ubiquity of this kind of rape culture, this sort of dominance over that continues over and over again. It's, you know, it's Shakespeare, it's hip-hop, it's, you know, everything in between and beyond. And, you know, it's really, that's something that in spite of the voices from within and from outside speaking about this is not gaining any sort of traction. And so this becomes part of the common element to me that speaks to this commodification and, you know, is part of the re-entrenchment. So while we can have some conscious hip-hop that's, you know, talking about liberations of all peoples, they're not, you know, we're not hearing the voices within so many of these spaces about the liberation of women, because so much of this liberation is built quite literally on the backs and fronts of women's bodies. And that I think becomes a troublesome aspect. So while, you know, as an out lesbian, the scantily clad women also can be titillating to me, there is a real push, from myself included, to complicate this rather than just dismiss it as pure pleasure. And I think, you know, we can really speak to that and come to some of the theoretical analysis of this, as well as, you know, just going ahead and getting messy with it and all the complexities, I think.
I want to thank the panel for a very interesting discussion. And I just want to make three quick comments that kind of stick in my mind after listening to you discuss these issues. First is that, and this comes from Crispin's, Professor Sartwell's discussion, is it possible to have a non-politicized artistic appreciation? And that comes from the Michelangelo example that you, because I think some members on the panel would say that even the act of consuming, even in a non-commercial way, listening to someone flowing on a street corner is a political act. So that's one issue of, is everything political, or is Crispin, would you defend the position that there is at least some areas of cultural appreciation that can be looked upon as non-politicized? The other thing on this issue of gender, very important issue of gender in hip-hop, and I'm not a student of hip-hop. All of you have me at a great advantage in that regard, but from someone looking at me outside, and I do recognize that sexist attitudes are in other cultural dimensions, whether movies or even rock and roll, but isn't there something approaching a qualitative difference in the sense of the graphic quality, or doesn't that matter? Doesn't it matter to us? And a related issue, which is my third point, in terms of the uniqueness of hip-hop culture and the reaction of, if you will, mainstream America or white America or whatever you want to call it, to this emerging, admittedly it's 40 years old, but this cultural tradition. It's not the first cultural tradition that African Americans have produced in the United States. Jazz and the blues. Did we have the same reactions to those art forms, or is there something different about hip-hop? Thank you so much.
Well, one thing I say is I don't hold out for any like pure unpoliticized appreciation. I mean, I don't mean like you just stare at the Sistine ceiling and you know absorb the pure form. I'm not a formalist in that way. I mean, I think every act of creation has a political context, and every act of appreciation has a political context. But what I will resist is like that there is nothing but the political in all of these experiences, because I find that extremely reductive or whatever, and not it's sort of just not true to our experience, So yeah, I end up with a pretty complex attempt at this. So I'm not look. I don't want to take like Jay-Z videos and just stare at them as if they have no political implications. And I would like to issue a political critique of Jay-Z videos. But I also simultaneously, and I think maybe this is essential maybe to understanding their political content, experience what is compelling about them, and aesthetically compelling. I think that can easily be lost if you try to, if your first move is to fit them into a political structure of understanding.
On the question about gender politics or about gender and representations in hip-hop, honestly, no. I don't see it so much as qualitatively different in hip-hop than I do in other forms of culture. I see the scapegoating of hip-hop as a way to remove any sort of responsibility for gender dynamics that fundamentally disadvantage women, especially sexually. And I see that happening quite a bit, but I don't see it as unique to hip-hop, nor do I see hip-hop as a particularly egregious form of it. I mean, I think about cock rock as violating, and if we're going to go, in these directions, or hair bands of the 80s, and all of their references, God help us. But I see this this sort of dynamic taking place everywhere. It's in the political arena. It's in the formal political arena. It's truly everywhere. It is so ubiquitous that we don't even see it. We don't pay attention to it. And then when something like hip hop comes up, we use this, I think, really to sort of trot out old and familiar and boring and racist tropes of black and Latino masculinity and sort of hypersexuality, mm-hmm. To let too many other people off the hook, including people who have power in all sorts of legitimate structural ways.
Okay, are you asking if there's something distinctive about hip hop, like as opposed to forms like jazz or blues or rock and roll, and if so, what is that difference?
Well, as I said, I'm not a student of hip hop, and I don't really know, frankly, the nature of the reaction. I just know that there's a huge kind of backlash to hip hop, and I'm just trying to be honest about that. And it seems to me that it's somehow qualitatively different from the way. I dimly understand how jazz and blues entered mainstream American culture back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
No, you're right.
There's something visceral
going on. There's something different.
And that's what I'm asking about.
Well, I mean, let me approach a couple things. One is that hip-hop is a post-civil rights phenomenon in a lot of interesting ways. And it's a post-civil rights phenomenon because in some ways it responds to the retrenchment of white supremacy in the late 70s and early 1980s. It's also a black art form that hits it big and does not suffer the same levels of appropriation that rock and roll does, or jazz for that matter. So it's a black form, black and Latino. And that's part of its threat, especially because very early on, rap shows are targeted by police as being these sites of disorder, and that could destabilize a whole community. And I think of like the Nassau Coliseum show in the late 70s. And the flip side of that is, to get back to Crispin's point, I think that that's also one of the reasons that academics are so interested in it, especially academics who are attuned to inequalities of race and studying power dynamics in American life are very interested in rap precisely because it is a black and brown form that whites sort of are at the periphery of, except in consumption, where they're at the center of. And the whole phenomenon of consumption, why do white suburban kids consume so much hip-hop? Those are very interesting questions for academia, and to authoritarian institutions in American life, they're very troubling questions. So I do think there's something qualitatively different about rap and hip-hop.
But also, that's why hip-hop did not elect Obama, though. Because, I mean, if you think about the appreciation of young white people for black pop music through the 20th century, it's extreme and continuous, you know? And if the fact that I like Little Richard would leave, you know, that didn't lead me to vote for Shirley Chisholm for president, you know what I mean? So I would resist that. But I do think, you know, even though hip-hop is very different and the reception of hip-hop is very different than, you know, blues or soul or whatever it may be, there's a lot of commonality, too. And one of the commonalities is the fascination of white people with black culture and especially black music. You know, it's an extremely problematic legacy, but interesting. You know, and it has racist implications, and it has liberatory implications. It's always ambiguous in that way. But it certainly throughout the 20th century, in one form or another. You know, always transforming, but always pretty central to American culture in a way.
I think another way in which it's qualitatively different is that it's not just an oral form. You know, the technology of video has made it accessible to a wide, you know, range of people in a very different way than earlier black musical forms. And so I think that there's a particular power in video that has had an incredible influence on shaping opinions and shaping desire and shaping behavior that does make this qualitatively different.
I think also in terms of the body, very different than earlier black vernacular forms. And I think that for a white suburban girl, like the kind of physical graffiti of it, and it sort of gives, it's just like this license to sort of be bad, right? Because your body is so policed in other ways. So it offers some other kind of form in a certain way to the suburban white consumer.
All right, I think we're wrapping it up there. I just want to say that Tammy Wynette's greatest moment was when she sang with the KLF. If you don't know it, look it up.
What was that song called?
On behalf of the Clark Forum Student Board, and Student Senate, I would like to thank our panelists and as well as our audience for coming this afternoon. We hope you can join us tonight at 7 p.m. in Anita Tuven-Schlechter Auditorium for Hip Hop in Action, which will feature performances by Hypnotic, Veach and Shante Paradigm Smalls, as well as an open mic session. So thank you very much.